Seb said, "You've probably been abducted and you just don't remember." And that really blew my mind. I said, whoa, hold on a second here. And I think it underscores the whole UFO subject, which is, and I think science is corroborating this now, reality is not what you think it is.
The book is UFO Symphonic. Mike Fiorito is the author, and he's done more than that. This isn't the only thing, but this is a really cool thing, of course, because my own experiences with esoteric, non-corporeal, all that good stuff, and he gets a little bit of everything in this book. So, Mike, this is a cool topic. I'm glad that you have put so many different elements of it together in your book. It's a sound thing. It's also unifying because of that. So if you could give us a backstory on you, your own history,
sure,
and then the deal with the book, because I think it's fascinating.
Sure. Well, thank you, Wendy. And I really appreciate you reaching out. And it's great to be on the show. And of course, I love talking about UFO Symphonic and the writing in general. Just to give a little bit of a backstory about me, I am an adjunct professor of English at the City University of New York. I teach at City Tech. I teach English composition, and I do a lot of different kinds of writing. You know, at the core, I'm an author and a journalist. And as you said in our preamble conversation, I've written across many, many topics. Initially, you brought up the flip in our preamble conversation. That was a big sea change for me. I have always been interested in science fiction. I've always been interested in the topics that make up ufology, which may include, you know, psychology, Jungian psychology. It may include cosmology, of course, science fiction. Am I missing anything? I've been very interested. Right. There's a lot of subject matter that really goes into. That's why it's a kind of a rabbit hole, because you go down the UFO topic and man, you accumulate quite a library and a lot of reading. But I had I've always been interested in the topic, but I'd never approached it the way that Jeff Kripal outlines it in The Flip, which is, you know, in short, getting us to leave things on the table that we don't understand, make room for the impossible. And I think it's so common in mainstream academics, for sure. If you have the subject matter of UFOs, of ghosts, of apparitions, of out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, you know, you tend to get the kind of glassy-eyed look or the eyeball roll from, you know, someone you're talking to. And I would say Jeff has done an amazing job of creating a framework for us to have conversations that are sober, and I think we get through, we connect to people who are on the other side of the subject. I've had that experience personally. After I read Jeff's book, after I read The Flip, I wrote to Jeff and I said, hey, I just wrote a book called Falling from Trees, which some of the stories deal with the future, the potential future of human sentience, of climate change, of, you know, encounters with non-human intelligence. And I feel like I read your book before I wrote my book, which would be impossible because it's just, you know, I've just read your book and my book published. And Jeff basically writes back and says something like, welcome to the club. You know, this is something that happens, I think, to people. Eric Wargo talks about it in Time Loops, that we have this kind of backward causality of, you know, and as I look at my life now, and as I said to you in the opener, it's as if I've been preparing for this all of my life. So it's very uncanny.
And that's the whole thing about it. There are synchronicities. There are little things that kind of tweak our maybe saying this is coming up in the future. We don't put it together until afterwards and then go back and connect the dots. I know that works for me.
Exactly. I don't know if, do you know Seb Talk? By any chance?
I'm familiar with the name, but no, I don't.
She's been in the UFO field for a while, and I had been on her podcast with the late, great, dear, very dear, all great. And she had said, we just had a conversation post the podcast, and I showed her these schematics that I drew when I was like 12. And they're schematics of spaceships and schematics of future technologies. And I had other drawings, pencil drawings I did much later, you know, maybe 20 years ago. And I told her about a dream that I had. I was being surveilled and kind of locked in some, you know, situation. It was this kind of like espionage kind of scenario. I don't remember the details. And Sev said, "You've probably been abducted and you just don't remember." And that really blew my mind. I said, whoa, hold on a second here. And I think it underscores the whole UFO subject, which is, and I think science is corroborating this now, reality is not what you think it is. And that's not to say that there aren't some things that are real, because there are. I mean, there are things, love is real. Being kind is real and important. And having being a good father is important, and being a good friend. So I'm not proposing to say that these are all completely illusory things and they're nonsense. That's not what I mean. I'm aligning more with kind of Tibetan Buddhism, I would say, you know, loosely, generally, that reality is provisional. And the provisional nature of reality should give us some room in between what we think we know and what is. And perhaps that little separation, that little distance can give us some compassion for the people around us, for the situations around us, and take our ego a little bit out of that to make room for other people's concerns, if that all makes sense to you.
Yeah. Well, and it's that we're trying to compartmentalize something. Recently, like in the past 5 years, when I described certain paranormal elements that went along with my own experiences, it's just now being allowed as part of the conversation that these things right. are not just a little blip in the sky or an orb. And not only that, is an orb a UFO? Technically, maybe, maybe not. All of the stuff that we've done to try and put it into a neat and tidy box or give it a label is completely off. It's off base because it isn't just that. It's so much more. And that's what we're learning, I think, on many levels. But you incorporate the sound element into this. And I think that is huge. Yeah. It's a big component.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. And I kind of, I paused because I didn't want to have like a 2-hour introduction of me. That's, you know, frankly, I'd rather have a conversation with you. But, you know, I'm a musician. And I'm also a music journalist. So, and I'm deeply interested in music. I know most people like music. I think there may be levels of how much someone may obsess on music. I'd say I've become pretty obsessive in terms of reading about and listening to and really focusing in and examining at the very detailed level. I think at the highest level, what I discovered, I shouldn't say that, not discovered, what I'm saying in UFO Symphonic is that music is a contact modality. And that's a very broad statement. And as you read in the book, you'll notice that, number one, the stories don't repeat. It's not everyone had an experience of seeing an illuminated object in the sky and there was music associated with it. Sometimes music came out of a vision, out of an encounter. And sometimes music can stimulate an encounter or a vision. And of course, then too, music is, I want it to be, to include more than just organized music, but sound. So that, you know, music and when we compose music, humans compose music, it's very organized, it's very structured, it has a time signature. And unless you're a modern composer and you're playing with those things. But then there's sound in general. So things like chanting. I read a book by, is it Joe Blowfield, I think, or John Blowfield. He was a scholar of Buddhism and other Eastern religions. And he wrote a book on mantras. And what he said is, using a mantra, you don't want to focus on what the meaning of the words are. More important are the sounds. And that using the sounds to chant, and I've, in my own experience, when I've chanted, it's much more powerful. It's much stickier to be a good meditator using mantras. But then there's other ways to connect with sound through, as I describe in the book, through sound baths. So I've gone to sound baths where they may use chimes or sound bells or bowls, and they have a whole kind of collection of percussive instruments that could be incorporated. And those things are very, very powerful. There's no doubt when you go into those sessions, something's going to happen. You're going to have sound wash over you. It's going to change your brain waves. It's going to have some effect. It may create visions. It may induce emotion. But something will happen to you. I mean, I can't guarantee that because, you know, not everybody is exactly the same. I should also say that there are people that for which sound is an incredible annoyance. My friend Kev Kahn, who wrote the prelude for the book, and I use the word prelude because that's a musical term. Kev is a high-functioning autistic, and sound drives him crazy. Music drives him crazy. So he can't relate to this stuff. But nevertheless, he read the book, and he could relate to the ideas in the book.
Another thing about that, I grew up in a house where my mom, when music was on, it was time for music, and then it was over. So it wasn't a 24/7. And the thing about that is it became special. So as an adult, I don't have music as my 24/7 background or TV or any kind of, because it's distracting. If I listen to music, I zone out. And so I can't focus or listen to the silence and other things that I hear with the music going. And it's like you go into somebody's alternate universe or their space of creation, and you for me, the best way to describe it is you vibe with them or vibe with their dream, their thought, their ideas. So I understand totally, and I'm not autistic. I'm just easily distracted, should I say it way.
Totally agree. But you know, when I'm writing, and that makes perfect sense, when I'm writing, I generally don't want to listen to music with words, because that could distract me.
Yeah.
Also, there's certain kinds of music that it just begins, like you said, it begins to pull me in, and I may listen to electronic music, which is kind of dreamy, and it's maybe there's a layer there that I get in touch with. I get in touch with something there, something imaginative. I like Brian Eno, his kind of repetitive, minimalist stuff, like Thursday Afternoon. It goes on for, you know, an hour, and it's very little modulation in the music. But I completely understand that. And I think music has, there are different purposes for music. And, you know, that's why I wanted to, in this book, I'm working on a follow-up book, and I'm sort of piecing it together. And I wanted to write a book that it could be read by anyone. It didn't have to be UFO-focused people. It could be read by anyone that appreciates how music can move you. I like to use the term music deliteralizes. It takes you out of your ego. And it could be as little as taking you out of your ego in the moment to the past, to the remembrance of something. Music connects us to something bigger. You know, they do it at sports events. You go to, you know, a sport event, and you'll hear music that can, you know, rile up the crowd, or things like the national anthem, music that connects, that binds, that brings us together. Pretty much every major event in our lives, weddings, funerals, graduations, it has a music component to it for a reason. And so I wanted to touch on those things too. And you'll notice in the book that the stories go from the prosaic to the absolutely magnificent and the incredible. And I wanted to have that spectrum. Also, I incorporated other people's stories. So I got the stories in various ways. I was on a podcast and someone wrote to me, or, you know, in various ways, I had people contact me, and I either transcribed what they wrote from a call or a video, a call, or I had them write it. And then, you know, we worked together to edit and refine it. But you'll notice, Wendy, I don't interpret their stories. I will intersperse my stories with their stories because, you know, I'm the writer. I need to carry the narrative. I need to be responsible for the book. But I thought that I wanted to hear other people's stories. And I use the word in the book polyphonic a lot, polyphonic meaning many voices. And it was important that, you know, I'm not proposing, I'm not saying, you know, this is the final statement. If anything, it's really the beginning statement. And there's, I'm going to be writing further stuff, and I'm hoping other people that connect on the subject matter connect deeply, for sure. And so there's a lot of, I've had a lot of conversations with people and follow-on conversations. So there's more to be done.
I think there's one in there about the flute, the magic flute. I love that story. Can you just, let's go with that one first as an example.
Sure. So, and it's funny because sometimes in the stories that frankly, I don't remember all the details. So you'll have to bear with me.
Okay.
Isn't that funny though? I mean, I wrote the damn thing and then sometimes you don't remember all the details.
I understand completely. Yes.
And it's funny because someone will read something from the book and say, oh, did I write that? Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. You know, conversely, sometimes, you know, you don't want to say, did I write that?
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
So I should let me take a step back in the story. Let me think of where to begin in the story because it's important. So, you know, I wrote a book inspired by Peter Rowan, the bluegrass musician. I met Peter and I was initially doing a short article with him. Peter has had, you know, at the time of the article had a 60 plus year career, massive career. And Peter is a raconteur. He's a bluegrass musician, but he was born in Wayland, Massachusetts. Very interested in poetry, painting. He's actually a very fine painter. He's a poet. He's a self-professed Buddhist. He's knowledgeable of a lot of wisdom traditions. So Peter is effectively blowing my mind. We're having this conversation. And from a little article, I write this book, Mescalito, Riding His White Horse. And subsequent to that, I made a lot of friends. The bluegrass world is not unlike the UFO world. You have a lot of specialists, you know, people that know very deeply, very specific things. And it's a small group of people. Mm-hmm. From that book, I met someone named Frank Serio, who's a photographer. And actually, he's a songwriter. His brother has played with the Allman Brothers and other groups. So when I met Frank, he told me about he had been with a woman who he was very much in love with. She passed away very young from cancer. And, you know, I would say, as is often the case, these anomalous experiences often have to do with, they often have to do with grief. You know, Jeff Kreipl will say this has everything to do with grief. To take a few steps back, when Frank, you know, when he would, they would write love notes to each other. And one of the love notes that they would write was, I love you more than anything. And then Frank would write back, I love you more than everything. And it was this kind of cute thing, right, that they would write back and forth to each other. I then saw, and I hope I'm not telling it out of chronological order, I went to a bluegrass festival and I saw Berlin Thompson perform the song that he wrote with Frank based upon the post-its that Frank left around the house. I have to tell you that the entire place was in tears when that song was presented. And he actually had to stop singing the song because he was crying. And the whole crowd was crying. So to go back to, you know, sorry for that long introduction, to go back to the story with Sue had a flute that had never played that was in a box in Frank's house. After one festival, Peter Rowan, who I wrote the book about, he comes over to Frank's house after the festival because it's the bluegrass community. People are very close and the musicians, you know, we tend to be friends with the musician. And Peter says, what's that box over there? And Frank says, oh, that's Sue's flute, right? Frank is so absorbed in wanting to tell Peter about a song that he's writing that he's not really thinking, right? And he begins to tell Peter about the song that he's writing, which is a kind of British Isles kind of style song. It's based on a folktale. Now, as Frank is telling the story, Peter is taking the flute out of the box. You have to assemble it. And he begins to toot on the flute. He begins to play on it. Frank's telling the story. The story is going on, you know, for at least as long as I've been telling you the story. I actually have it on audio. I have the whole thing on audio. Frank's thinking, Peter's not even paying attention. He's just staring at me, and he's lost in space, and he's playing the flute. And then Peter says, okay, write this down. And Frank says, what? Let me get a pen and paper. And then Frank takes out his phone and begins to record. And so Peter says, here's the first verse. Here's the melody. Here's the second verse. Oh, and that thing you were doing, that's the chorus. Okay, so we got the song down. So this is a kind of a flurry of a thing. To write a song with Peter Rowan is a major honor, right? So Frank is beyond, you know, beyond elated. They put the flute down. They kind of, things change, conversation changes. And then Pete goes to get the flute again to play on it, and it won't play. It's just dead. It's like, it won't play. And they really never discuss it. You know, it's just one of those things, they just didn't talk about it. What Frank thought afterwards was that, you know, his love for Sue kind of came to life and breathed life into the flute, just enough to make time to write the song. And then, you know, I'm sure someone can scientifically say, well, here's the reason, this, you know, this and that and whatever. But how uncanny is that, that the song was, you know, written in the time it took for the flute to be operational and then no more? Kind of incredible.
I loved it. I loved it because it was, that's what happens. That's how it works. And then you go from that story into the Michael Shermer story.
Right, exactly. And so Michael Shermer had a story where it's kind of similar. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about, to connect his experience, who he's a debunker. You know, he's like a serial debunker, Michael Shermer, right? And I believe he has a science background, but he's well known in the UFO community for, in a sense, being, there's nothing wrong with being skeptical, but he's kind of like a jerk, I guess is what you'd say. Sorry about that. You know, but that's just the truth. It's one thing to be, and this is where I think this is where Jeff has done us a great justice, is providing, okay, you can be a jerk, you can be a debunker, but you should at least listen to this and to say, well, I don't know why, I don't understand. But Michael Shermer has a story that he and his wife, and I'm again sketching it because I don't remember all the details. He and his wife got married. His wife's, I think, grandfather couldn't be at the wedding. They get married. They come back home to the house that they're living in, and there's a radio playing. And they don't know where the music's coming from. And it's like playing this 20s kind of stuff that her grandfather would have liked. And they finally, they go and find it. I don't know where it is, but it's like in the attic, let's say. And the damn thing is playing a song. And the Michael Shermer's wife felt, this is my grandfather, you know, who couldn't be here, letting his presence be known. Then the music turns off. Michael Shermer is a bit of a tinker. Maybe not that night, but you know, sometime after, he takes apart the radio. He can't figure out what the heck happened. Why did this thing start playing? And at that time, and then with that music, that is very uncanny. So who's pulling the levers, I think, is really the question there.
He had to admit that one he couldn't debunk, which was brilliant.
Right.
It was brilliant because it was one of the things that actually made him, for a moment, take a step aside and say, wow, Okay, and that was what I liked about that story, because he's very well known for pouring whatever you can, salt, cold water, you know, ashes, whatever, on everything. And there's never a, well, and this is why it won't work. No, it's just, it won't work. When you hear something like that from someone who is so adamantly opposed about any of this being possible, it makes you question, and that's the whole point.
And I think something I said was something that there's a spirit or a being that it wants to be heard. And so it finds a way to be heard and to do something. I think what often is the case with the phenomena, as I call it in the book, throughout the book, is like a dream. And then there's a lot of correspondence between having encounters and dreams. And I don't mean that to denigrate the quote-unquote reality of the encounter and experience, but that it's anomalous, it's analogous, I mean to say, that when people have a UFO encounter, it's often you'll see that the object zigzags. It moves in ways that it doesn't in reality, in everyday reality. The observed behavior of phenomena, of extraordinary anomalous phenomena, tends to be noticeably different from how things behave in everyday reality. And it reminds me of, have you ever practiced or studied lucid dreaming?
Oh yeah, yes, and I've had lucid dreams.
Okay. So when you to help you become cognizant of when you're lucid dreaming, there are practices that people do where they'll say, you know, throughout the day, am I dreaming? Am I dreaming? Okay, look at how the light in the room works. You know, look at how the walls in my apartment look. Has the ceiling opened and is something, you know, drifting through the ceiling? And in a way, it's not unlike what we do, you know, what the word Buddha means, awake. So the idea to be awake in every moment, to be awake, because we fall asleep, we dream, we create the world in our dreams, in our egos, you know, and again, tying back to that notion of ego. And it's interesting that when we dream, I've had lucid dreams where I've said, oh, that is not supposed to happen. I'm dreaming. And now I wake up and now I become a little bit, I'm awake inside the dream. I mean, the problem is I've never really developed it to a super high level. I've gotten too excited.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm jumping on that. I'm flying through the sky or doing something extraordinary. But I think there's an interesting connection between dreams and the phenomena. I think dreams are a portal to that experience. But to get back to the idea of music, you know, the stories, again, you know, this was one story where it was, you know, an object, a flute. It was an object. And then through grief, there was something incredible that happened that connected, in this case, Frank to his beloved Sue Cunningham. There are other stories, too. There's one story about another musician who he actually plays with Peter Rowan, Max Wareham. And Max was kind of in this point in his life where he says, I don't know if I want to play. He's a banjo player. I don't know if I want to play. And, you know, this whole thing is so, you know, music is a tough gig, really tough gig. He was kind of having doubts about it. And he wanted to do something. He'd always been interested in archaeology. And so he goes on this dig. It's somewhere in bluegrass country, which is interesting. So he goes on this dig and he goes to this event, which is in a very rural part of, let's say, Tennessee, because I just don't remember. So it's not a big festival. It's not one where I've been to the big festivals and they get much more, they're much more mainstream, and you're not sometimes in the remote hills of a, you know, X county. So here Max goes to this place and he's really uplifted by this. These are people that just love, this is their culture. This is not a show to, you know, it's not a show to sell tickets only. It's a show of people presenting the music they love in a very authentic way. And he finds that very inspiring. But one thing that also happened is when he goes on this dig, he finds something in the dig. He finds something that they have to kind of stop, because when you get to a certain point and you're digging, you have to stop. And now you need the specialist to get in there. And the leader of the group said, well, Max, since you have, you're a musician and you have very delicate and your hands are very flexible, why don't you, you know, continue with this? And so Max takes out this thing. And what it is it's a piece of earthenware from a vase. And it turns out that it's a vase of a shaman, you know, a chief from this tribe.
Yeah. I remember, this, there was somebody there on the dig who was a Native American. And so they said, do you know what that is?
Right, right. And then it leads to, you know, this thing where now you have to have a ceremony, you have to involve other people. But it's Max, you know, in his quest for trying to find the purpose of music for him, he comes into contact with a spirit from another place and time. That's just nothing short of incredible. And it's specifically because he's a musician and his dexterous hands are being called upon to do the digging. And in fact, he was doing the digging in the first place.
What I love about that is the thing that it said from the Native American perspective was, you didn't find it, it found you. And there's the reason right. that it was called to him or calling him, and he was put in that position. I like that other element.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, that I thought my point, I guess, is that, and I've said this to you previously, but I didn't want to just have the same story 15 times over. And I wanted them to be very relatable to anyone. My hope and goal is that the book is, at the end of the day, it's a humanities book. And the point is not to push music. I mean, maybe it's myth that spurs you on, or maybe it's art. Someone asked me, I presented the book at a bookstore and said, why didn't you include all art in your book? And I said, well, I didn't want a 1,000-page book, number one.
Yeah.
Right? And I really wanted to focus it. There are the books that cover that. There was really no book that I have come across that specifically goes into, not in an anecdotal way, to say John Lennon had a UFO sighting.
Right.
This, David Bowie had a UFO sighting. But what is the connective tissue? And why would it, music and sound be something that connects us to the phenomena? And what is that phenomena? And of course, it's very broad. So that's, I think, what I wanted to try to do. I feel it's somewhat unique. It may disappoint the UFO only people, you know. And for that, I say, you know, I'm sorry. I have to come at a topic with my authentic interest. And at the end of the day, I want to tell a great story, and I want it to be hopefully beautifully written. And hopefully the where I'm coming from authentically in the UFO conversation is clear.
I think you are. But I also, you know, yeah, people who are just in the UFO, it's more nuts and bolts, and does the government have the information, and can they prove it, and all about disclosure. This is about how it interacts, how we interact on multiple levels with that element. And it's, I think, the lightning striking story, Leanne, is one that yeah. delves into that, because she starts out, her background is a professional infectious disease epidemiology person. Hello, UFO, really?
Right.
Okay, so that goes into, well, how does the sound connect the dots?
Exactly, and you know, there were other, so there's Dana, who's a biologist, as well. There's another woman, Laura. You know, there are a number of PhDs that are, you know, they're professional career scientists. My goal was to not focus on the celebrity of the person writing the story or yeah. giving the story, but just focus on the story. Leanne was an epidemiologist, And, you know, she had said she just recently at the time that she's telling me, she had separated from her boyfriend or a fiance, I don't remember. And, you know, was of course, again, we have the notion of grief. We have the notion of loss. And she started to get into crystals, and she started to, then I was introduced to her by someone else who said, Leanne has a very special connection to music. And so what Leanne was telling me in the story is that it's a couple of stories that she told me, but the one I'll start off with to say that she was telling me that her porch became a spaceship. Her porch became a vehicle that took her to places and times to provide singing for healing to people whom she did not know, to beings whom she did not know. And she said, and by the way, she said, I'm not a good singer. So I don't know why I was chosen. So.
Look at me.
So she's squawking, you know, in to something somewhere, but it was meaningful. And that's extraordinary in and of itself, that the notion that, and I should say that everyone I talked to, you know, there was a kind of a soberness, a seriousness about the people. I did talk to people whose stories did not make it in. You know, I'm a journalist, and I think I have a decent sense of trusting someone's story. And everyone that talked to me had those experiences. They all had those experiences. They weren't bragging. They weren't trying to get a story in a book. They may have even been somewhat reluctant sometimes. So she then told me that she began to associate songs with different, say, people. And it was like a constellation of things. The song would have a kind of a crystal component. And it would be connected to a person or an event or something. So she was having she was discovering, she said she didn't know the song previously, Like a Bridge Over Troubled Water. You know, I don't recall all the lyrics offhand, but it starts out very kind of ominous. When you're down and feeling blue, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. And she was driving to her parents. She lives in Georgia. I think she was going to Tennessee, and it was raining. It was pouring rain out, cats and dogs. And it's the kind of rain where it's super dark and the rain is so thick. I've just did that not too long ago where your windshield is, you know, cloudy. You just can't see. There's not enough light on the highway. It was at night, and she's kind of not feeling great, you know. And this song comes on, and she said she hears the song, and, you know, the song begins in a kind of it begins negatively, you know, when you're weary, when times get rough and friends can't be found. And then it reaches a song, when darkness comes and pain is all around. And then it says, she was saying, she's driving and saying to herself, God, please. You have to give me a sign. You have to help me here. I'm feeling lost. And she said, suddenly lightning struck and it illuminated her windshield. So it was like the whole windshield, like, you know, just lit up brilliantly like it would. But I don't think the lightning struck the windshield, but it was close proximity. And she said, and it struck as it said, I will lay me down. Sail on, silver girl, sail on by. And it's this kind of where the song lifts now. And here she is, she's crying, right? And because of the lightning, she saw to the left, I don't remember if it was left or right, she sees, okay, this is the exit I have to take. And then she was able to safely pull, you know, off of to the exit and continue on her destination. But just the timing of that, again, uncanny. You know, can Michael Shermer explain it away? Can someone explain it away? It's very synchronicity, if that's a word.
Yeah.
Just a very, an amazing moment. You know, I've had times where, and I'm sure you have, where I'm saying something, I'm thinking something to myself, and as I say the sentence is said by someone else somewhere else. Like I'm watching a TV show or I'm listening to something, and the same sentence comes out, and it's not because I'm anticipating what I just happen to be saying. And these synchronicities, these kinds of things are, they're little crumb drops to say, to lead us to something bigger, something more magnificent. It's like they're little wake-up calls to say, hello, hello, I'm here. There's something bigger and more extraordinary. It's not just all nuts and bolts, people.
Yeah, pay attention. Okay, I'll add, I think the timing on this experience I just had recently and the music element is interesting. And so I have to build it up just a little bit.
Please.
Okay. Okay. Recently, my husband saw a blue light outside the bedroom I was in when I was asleep. And I had at the very same time, without him knowing, felt someone was there. So I knew somebody was there, not anyone you could see. Okay. And things like that have been increasing recently. So as someone called me and said, we think we have a ghost. Could you please tell us what's happening? And so I said, well, recently deceased farmer and some other things. And they confirmed it. So we had a conversation about that, about what was going on with that. But then they said, well, there's something else that seems to be older in the house. Now, I had picked up on that, but it didn't seem to be relevant because it's not causing a problem. It doesn't want to be seen. It is ancient. And I said, okay, well, the only thing I get with that, just to put your mind at ease, is that there was a campfire and I see ashes. And what I get is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And it's kind of, it just means it's not a negative. It means it's no longer relevant. It's old history. And they said, well, is it in the woodwork? No, it's the foundation and it's deep. It's a past history. Okay, so as I'm going out later that day, I'm walking the dog and thinking about a turtle that I'd had as a pet and really, really sad because I didn't know how it ended up for the turtle. He was a really cool character, Stan the Turtle Man, and a red slider. As I'm walking and thinking about this for several minutes, on our path directly in front of us is a red slider, a big turtle. He pokes his head out from the weeds along the path, and I'm like, oh my gosh. This is what Stan would have looked like if he had continued. Okay, so I'm having this amazing thing because the turtle allows us to stay close. Not only that, and we get off side beside him so that we don't, he actually comes out on the path in front and then starts going in front of us. I don't want to step in front of him to scare him. He does put his head up to see where we are. We go alongside to pass him, the dog and I get about 10 feet in front, turn around. Of course, I take pictures. I say, is this okay? He seems to be fine. And then I see we're about maybe 20, quite a ways past the turtle. I turn around. I look. He has parked himself on the opposite side, waiting and watching us as we continue far down the path. And so there's that moment. Okay, there's that moment. After that, I see another turtle. No, it's a turtle shell. This turtle is desiccated. It has been, it's long gone, but it's the shell, the remnant. So here we go, the cycle of life. I get into the vehicle on the way home. In the car, the song comes on, Kansas. And it's Dust in the Wind. And as the person says at the end, the DJ says, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Okay, so there I get the whole thing with the ashes under the house and me going, you know, that ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and saying this isn't a negative. This is, and so it gives me a very clear corroboration of the circle or the cycle of life. On we go. And I just thought, oh my gosh. So for me, these were like little bookmarks and embellishments and lightning strikes and, oh my gosh, moment, each and every one of them, because it was continuing this whole spectrum. And again, the precursor of remembering that we have help from whatever side it comes from and not necessarily maybe what we think and what we're caught up in our construct. There's more going on. And that's what I love about the UFO thing. Right now, it has blown this area, this field wide open, saying it isn't just about those little things in the sky. It's about how connected right. we are on multiple levels. Not just, I mean, they're just now pulling in the paranormal with the deceased, the afterlife, the OBEs, all of that stuff, saying, whoa, where does it stop?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's about metaphysics, and it's about, it has everything to do with consciousness.
Yeah.
And, you know, what does it mean to be conscious? And does my consciousness create reality? Is reality out there? I mean, there's a whole, you know, whole load to talk about in that regard. But I think it like you're saying, it kind of throws a rock through the window of, it's not this this objective reality that, you know, our science is just going to find and discover. But there's something about our consciousness that's involved in the creation of the reality that we perceive. And, you know, very well could be the linchpin that really helps us understand the universe itself. I mean, they're saying that experiments in quantum mechanics, that the observer influences the outcome. It's as if, like, consciousness is necessary. It's not just billiard ball that someone objectively hits and then, you know, the balls bounce into each other, and we're always going to get, based upon mathematics, this exact outcome. No, it has something to do with the individual perceiver that influences the outcome, which is another way to describe what magic is.
Well, it's extra dimensional. You know, so, whatever it is, it's we have this really nice, finite, solid reality we think is here. It's all concrete. This is not the concrete we're working with.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this is a different kind of concrete. This is the next level concrete, yeah. And that's right. Where we're going.
And there are wisdom traditions that have, you know, penetrated this long before you know, we in the West have, or at least in our modern technological Western civilization. But there are esoteric traditions that have had these notions. And you know, you go back and you read the Rig Veda. These ideas are you know, in these ancient texts, even in the West, in the Greek philosophers, Iambicus, and other writers that had the sense of interconnectedness and, you know, kind of mind blowing cosmic views of reality. And it's interesting that we have to look back to look forward.
That's part of it, though. That's part of it. I mean, when we're experiencing the here and now, it can be overwhelming. And so if you're, especially if it's a traumatic event, if it's something that's going to cause PTSD afterwards, which I've been through that, and then going through on the flip side and saying, oh, wow, I wasn't aware of this. Oh, now, yeah, and this happened and that happened. And sometimes it takes years to go back through and say, how did this affect me? And why did I respond that way? And how come I can't sleep at night? And how come I wake up when somebody makes a tiny noise or I jump? What is that about? And then going, oh, I'm okay. That was me. And that was startling. And so I'm okay now. But I also know what to do because of this, in terms of my activity, my consciousness, my psyche has changed as a result of that. And we grow. But mm-hmm. It's so much happening in the reality of trying to, in some way, get a context for it beyond the trauma mm-hmm. that it takes a while. And so, you know, this is what these paranormal things do to us. They say, wake up, you can't think that mm-hmm. way anymore. You got to get beyond the linear. It isn't 1-2, it's 1-4-8-Q.
mm-hmm. And it's somewhere. It's non-linear, which is what you were saying. There are ways to get in touch with that. You know, Tarot is one way to get in touch with it, or, you know, myth, or just things that are trigger points, music, sound, things that take us out of our complete sense of absolute all-knowingness to maybe have something from the unconscious rise up, something we're not aware of in our immediate an everyday reality that is so demanding just to get by, right? Just to make a living, to feed our families, to be keep everyone safe, all of that. That's so consuming, and I understand why most people are focused on that. It's interesting, you know, you mentioned disclosure, and for all intents and purposes, it's like disclosures happen. You've had people come out, David Grush, and all of these, you know, former military people, and with these extraordinary stories. You had, you know, sightings. We had the Tic Tac video, and you know, most people are like, "Oh, that's amazing. Okay, what's next? What's for dinner?"
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, because it's probably hard to square. It's hard to square with our everyday, and for some people, it could be. And it's not a judgment. It's just overwhelming. It is overwhelming.
There's another thing about it. There's still a stigma.
Yeah.
Because it's UFO. That's one dimensional.
Right.
So once it has that category, that label UFO, then it's like, oh yeah, no biggie. But if you go right into the other elements that factor in, when you start saying, I felt a vibration, I heard a tone, the air darkened, there was electronic fog, there was a chill in the air, I had goosebumps. When you start factoring in all those other elements, the lights dimmed, you know, all of that. Wait a minute, this is connected. It isn't just out there. It's all around us. And that's what this does. Your stories are really helpful at bringing those other elements, the experiences of these unique events ties it together, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it shifts over time, you know, so that the, you know, as Valet has talked about, as Tulsa and other folks have written about, we perceive the phenomena in a dressing, in a decoration that comports to our context. You know, so for now, at this time, and since maybe post-World War II, it's metallic flying saucer type objects. It looks like technology. It has looked like other things in other cultures at other times. Sometimes it's a djinn, and sometimes it's a fairy. So it sort of seems to, we perceive it through the lens of our cultural context. And who knows, in some future context, what that would be. You know, that's an interesting thing, but it could be something, as of yet, we can't fathom.
The djinn story is like, whoa, my gosh. Okay, yeah, that makes you think, okay? What was really going on there? All right, that's a plug. We're not going to talk about it. We're just saying that's in the book.
Yeah. And there's, you know, I tried to cover, go into rhythm is super interesting and, of course, is hypnotic and a very important component. But I also tried to go into, pull a fairy story that involved music. And, you know, to go across different subject matter, mythology, there's a linguistic story in there as well. I was captivated by something I had read in my research. And then, you know, me, I'm in a glutton for punishment. So I don't just read the part that's about the research, I read the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. it takes a while.
But yeah, so... and. You know, I'm so glad that you connected with the stories, and you see the big picture I'm trying to present. I don't want to go too much into the detail of what I'm doing now, just because it's just a continuation of it, and it's taking a slightly different perspective, drilling down in a more specific way. But I do want to incorporate stories as well that involve music, so we should connect again for sure.
Yeah.
To talk about your music-related stories, because I do want to intersperse them in a similar way like I've done in UFO Symphonic.
I'll leave you one more. Okay. Fairies do sing. And I talked about this just recently because I had an imaginary friend as a kid, but this was out in the garden as an adult. And I was pulling weeds. I'll make it real short. Pulling weeds, and it looks like it may, there's the clouds above the house, but technically the rain is a little to the north and the south is okay. As I am pulling weeds, I hear these voices, and they're little like helium-type voices. Mother, bring the rain that we might drink. Little tiny voices, helium, yeah, all around. And they're singing a chant, Mother, bring the rain that we might drink. And that's it. So we get some sprinkles, and that's done. And I thought, that's all they wanted. They just wanted a nice little an affirmation that their voices had been heard. And I just, because I was just thinking, I was, you know, totally in the yard, not listening to anything, just kind of, you know, doing the weed thing. And that was it. So, yeah, those are fairies. Just so you know, yes, they're here. They're in your garden, and they're waiting for you to listen. How's that?
Well, I will say, I'll say this as maybe a parting thing. We have a garden. I live in an apartment building in Brooklyn, New York. And we have folks that take care of the garden. I mean, there are people that live here. They volunteer, and it's a beautiful garden. And mm-hmm. it's a really beautiful. It's such a pleasure to walk out. And here, yes, in Brooklyn, we do have trees and birds, and we have a plethora of bird types. And because of the garden, they're attracted to our garden.
Yeah.
About 4 months ago, maybe a little more, I was walking back into the apartment complex, and I was entering the concourse. I must have done something at some point to someone, because I tripped and I fell into the concrete stairs of the concourse. My hands were deep in my pockets because it was cold. It was winter. Mm-hmm. So I broke my humerus, which wasn't very humorous, a bone. You know, I have to say the force that I got pulled down, it just seemed uncanny. A couple of days afterwards, I left some cookies by a little flower bed in the garden. And I, you know, if I had said something or done something, I apologize, because it was uncanny the way that I was thrust down. And a lesson, a very powerful lesson, I should say, Wendy, because when you're saying things like reality is provisional.
Yeah.
Okay, go break your arm mm-hmm. and then say that again. And when you're in pain and you're saying reality is provisional, ow.
Yeah.
And then come over, go past that concept. Reality is sticky and it's powerful.
It reflects you. It reflects you. And if you did something that was disrespectful, the atonement, the effort at atonement is huge. It's huge because that is also acknowledged. And it may seem so trivial to anybody who hasn't experienced this, but the reality is we don't know everything. And there are mm-hmm. things that can surprise us. And that is one of those things that when you felt that, that's your reality. Nobody can take that away. And it's up to you to go what direction you want from there. I think that what you demonstrate is respect. And that's worth its weight in gold.
Well, thank you. I learned a lot from it. I'm learning a lot from it. It was ironic and rich and interesting, because I was writing about that subject. And here I was confronted with, like getting hit in the head with a sledgehammer. Okay, this is a real bang. Uh-huh. How real is
yeah.
that?
Yeah. If you discounted the potential, the possibility that something like this could exist, then sometimes that something then manifests to make you say, sorry.
Exactly.
Sorry. Exactly. Okay.
Humbled I was.
Okay. I tell you what, the book available now, and it's Mike Fiorito.
Yes. And you can go to my website, mikefiorito.com. That's FIORITO. You can get in touch with me if you have a music-related story or you just have a question, and I would love to hear from you. And you'll see all the books there. It's more than just one. I have another UFO-themed book called For All We Know, and I would love to hear from you. And Wendy, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate that you thoroughly read the book. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
I tried to do my research. All right. Plus, I like the topic, and I was afraid if I didn't read everything, I might miss something cool. All right. So that, for anyone listening, that's your homework. It's worth reading the whole thing. Okay. Don't just skip to the end.
Well,
thank you.
You are a gem. Thank you so much. And let's do speak though, because I want to talk to you about.
Yes.
I want to talk to you about your music story and see how we can work that into the next effort.
Okay. Well, that's great. And that's great. I'm glad you're still on this, because there's so much more to cover. So thank you. Thank you. And thank you for listening.
Okay. Yes. Thanks, everyone. I wanted to write a book that it could be read by anyone. It didn't have to be UFO-focused people. It could be read by anyone that appreciates how music can move you.